from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Look, I love Connecticut. I've lived in Connecticut. I have so many friends in Connecticut. How did you lose General Electric? How did you lose General Electric?
The New York Times and investigators have gone back and found these handwritten ledgers that are off-the-book payments.
Donald Trump shaking up his campaign leadership team again for the second time in 2 months.
Since 2007, both Clintons, because they're filed together, $43,885,000 and change. That's how much they've paid in taxes.
Usain Bolt gets it! 980! A magnificent seven!
This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. A little bit of news out of context. I'd love to talk more about Usain Bolt, perhaps, than Donald Trump today, but we're going to start there, and you can join us at 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Susan Bigelow, contributing columnist at CTNewsJunkie.org. Hello, Susan.
Good morning.
And at CTNewsJunkie.com.
I think
it's very important. We're .orging everything these days because it's public radio. Max Reese, NBC's NBC Connecticut's political reporter, is here as well. You work for a .com, right, Max?
We are definitely a .com. No tax exemptions here.
Absolutely. Well, let's get to the big news of this morning. The Trump campaign has been shaken up once again. It seems now Donald Trump unhappy with Paul Manafort. We were planning on talking quite a bit about the Paul Manafort escapades and some of the problems he's been having with his ties to Ukraine. But we're going to have to put that aside for just a moment to talk about the fact that Donald Trump seemingly has hired an executive from Breitbart News, Stephen Bannon, to head up his campaign, jumping above Paul Manafort in the pecking order, a chief executive for the Trump campaign, don't you know? He's also been talking quite a bit with Roger Ailes from Fox News, it turns out, to get him ready for this upcoming debate. I mean, I don't know, Colin, should we be surprised that the Trump campaign is shaking itself up once again?
Well, there's sort of two different narratives that are being floated here as to why this is actually happening, and specifically why it's actually happening to Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort, of course, a man with long and complicated Connecticut ties. His family is the Manafort Construction Company. His father was the mayor of New Britain. But he went off and became a Republican operative, playing at a much more national level and then an international level. So there's sort of, here's the two storylines. One of them is that most people probably know by now, Manafort's name has been surfacing. You heard a little bit of it in the montage there. His name has been surfacing in connection with sort of a corruption probe in Ukraine, where he was, in fact, a consultant, at minimum, to the now deposed president, pro-Russian president Yanukovych. There were ledgers that showed him getting, I think, $12.7 million. But then as of this morning, the AP broke another part of this story, basically saying that it appears that Manafort also played a role in shoveling payments to two U.S. lobbying firms, again, on behalf of Yanukovych interests, trying to get basically pro-Ukraine or pro-Russian version of Ukraine messages or activities performed by two U.S. lobbying firms. Now, ordinarily, that has to be subjected to quite a bit of sunshine. And it's the allegation in the AP story, all this is just kind of developing, and so forgive me if I don't dot every I and cross every T correctly, but the allegation basically is that Manafort may have played a role in concealing the fact that money from the Ukraine was getting into the American lobbying process. So that's number one. The number two storyline, it's one that was floated on Morning Joe a little while ago, and so you know it's probably not true.
Absolutely.
No, yeah. No, I'm kidding. But
thank you for supporting my company, by the way, Colin. I appreciate that.
That somehow or other, Trump was unhappy with the role that Manafort was playing, that he didn't like the narrative that Manafort was the guy brought in to manage him, that Manafort was the guy to get him to act more responsibly, and that was his job, and he either was or was doing it. I think from the outside looking in, it seemed like this was a wildly unsuccessful effort, if that's what it was supposed to be. And it was. I mean, he was supposed to be the political professional who was going to say, no, that's not how you run a presidential campaign. This is how you run a presidential campaign. No evidence that his message ever reached Trump's ears, but there's a notion anyway that Trump didn't even like that idea very much.
I will say, Susan, that of those two scenarios as to why Paul Manafort is not running the Trump campaign as of right now, I would tend to go with, I can't believe I'm saying this, the Morning Joe version. which is that Donald Trump probably is much more concerned about how it looks that he is being managed and being boxed in and being told not to be the Donald Trump of old. He cares much more about that than the possibility that Paul Manafort was actually directing some sort of Ukrainian funds into the U.S. political process. That's everyone does that. But this other thing, that's the sort of thing that Donald Trump didn't need anymore.
Well, the thing is that you can direct as many Ukrainian funds into the U.S. as you want to, as long as you register. You're supposed to register. If you're influencing U.S. policy from abroad, you're supposed to register it, and it's supposed to be very open. And he didn't do that. That's a big no-no. But yeah, I think you might be right. And there's an unflattering comparison here with Yanukovych, and it's amazing that there is that Trump is actually looking worse than Yanukovych, who is a man who stole an election in 2004 and actually got Manafort on board to make him look better after that. And actually, Manafort was quite successful. He turned Yanukovych more towards the West. He moderated him, and Yanukovych actually listened to him. And he actually won his election for prime minister and then president as a sort of pro-Russian. He was turned from a very sort of hardline pro-Russian guy into this very nice, moderate, I'm listening to everybody sort of president. And Manafort, I assume, was probably supposed to play the same kind of role. Manafort is this kind of mercenary. He's worked for a bunch of really sort of nasty characters like Ferdinand Marcos in the past. And so there's another unflattering comparison. But I think that you're right. I think that Trump had no interest in listening to the probably fairly good advice that Manafort has for taking somebody who's fairly despicable and turning them into someone the electorate would actually accept.
Max?
I think in the American, if we're going to look at this through the American political lens, I think it's just frankly rinse and repeat what we've seen the entire Trump campaign. He got rid of Lewandowski. What happened? Then Paul Manafort comes in. Well, now he's getting rid, in effect, I think in the next 2 weeks we're going to find out that Paul Manafort's no longer on the campaign. I think that that is a very distinct possibility. And now he's bringing in two more people. And I think what the ripple effect is going to be is Republican Party establishment, the donor types, the major strategists are going to start saying, now is where you start pulling back resources from Trump and you try to hope to the political gods you can protect your House and Senate seats down the ballot. I think they're going to say, look, we're not the disorganized mess that the Trump campaign is. We want to protect our Senate and House majorities. I think that that is going to be one of the trickle-down effects of what happens with the most recent Trump shakeup.
You see that happening? Because I don't know that I've seen that much coordination amongst the Republican Party, either in Washington or across America, to make that distinction, to actually jump on that train and say, we do need to protect something here from this disorganized mess.
I think that's a great point. To say it's super organized, no, because this campaign has been anything but organized. But I do think that there would be a concerted effort to at the very least distance themselves in a maybe more obvious way, where the answer from a swing House seat in, let's say, Pennsylvania, or a Pat Toomey might say, well, yeah, I'm not endorsing Trump. Let's not talk about Trump. Let's talk about this thing I did for this mining town about 3 weeks ago. I think it's going to be far more obvious in that regard. And I think that GOP strategists are going to be saying, how on earth do we distance ourselves from Donald Trump with another mess?
I think it's already happening. I think you saw it happen over the last week or so. Reince Priebus, the head of the RNC, a Republican national chairman, had an off-the-record meeting with 14 journalists. And what are the chances that that's really an off-the-record meeting? That's how you trial balloon something, right? So at this off-the-record meeting that nobody was ever going to hear about, of course, one of the things—
How did you hear about it, Colin?
It was in Politico.
That's right.
Because Politico was in credential. They didn't get invited to this, which meant that Politico was not on an off-the-record basis. They were free to take out all their friends who got invited to this meeting, get them drunk.
And then Priebus has to figure out, who were you texting?
Yeah, exactly. but he wants this information out. And the information was that they already have a plan. If this campaign doesn't pivot successfully by mid-October, they're going to cut off funding and concentrate on the down-ballot races for the last 3 weeks. Well, that's not true either. You know, I think what's true is what's happening right now, what Max is basically saying, which is that they've already made a decision that they have to separate somehow, right? They have to separate their brand from Trump's somehow without completely selling them out. But, yeah, for Toomey, for Ayotte in New Hampshire, for Portman in Ohio, for Rubio in Miami, they can't run with without creating some daylight between Trump and their candidates. They've got to be able to say, this guy is not that guy. I just want to just two other quick things about Manafort. One of them is, I think it's possible to overstate how good he actually was. I think in some ways, representing dictators isn't a good way to really prepare for returning to a democracy. And as a result, I think one thing jumps to mind, which was after the Melania plagiarism incident. Remember, he was the guy who went out there and said, there was no plagiarism. There was no plagiarism whatsoever. And then like 12 hours later, they're feeding some staffer to the machine saying—
But Ukraine was a democracy then. Well, it was. There actually was a fairly chaotic and lively democracy. Mm.
But I'll also ask the question, does the Trump campaign look any different today than it did back in June or May when Paul Manafort was brought on in the campaign?
Right.
I think the answer is no.
Yeah, then that may not be Manafort's fault. But the other thing I would just quickly say, somebody pointed this out on Twitter, I think today is the first day that Donald Trump gets, everybody gulp now, his first intelligence briefing. And I believe bringing General Michael Flynn and Chris Christie to the briefing with him. But somebody suggested on Twitter that, you know, one of the first things they may say is, let me just tell you about this Manafort situation, because you're going to need to know that, all right? He may get briefed about his own campaign chairman by the intelligence community of the United States.
Well, let's just get a little sense of about how much the Trump campaign has changed. It turns out that last Saturday night on a hot and stormy day, Trump held a rally at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. He couldn't help but take some shots at the media, of course.
Oh, look, the cameras are turned. Oh, look. The cameras are turned. Wow. Oh, that's great. Those cameras never, ever turn unless it's a protester, because, see, a protester is considered a bad thing for Trump. Oh, he had a protester. So I didn't think they could turn, but when there's a protester, they're like pretzels. They can turn, Giacomo. They can turn like pretzels. Look, did you believe that all the cameras were turned? Oh, what a bunch.
Before I get to the next piece of tape, so, Max, you were actually there, right?
Yes.
It's kind of hot in the room, wasn't it?
It was one of the single most physically uncomfortable places I have ever been in my life. It was easily between 90 and 100 degrees in a room filled with 5,000 of my closest friends.
My goodness. And of course, your closest friends, people who are taunting you, I'm quite sure, because you're one of those pretzels, those dishonest media types.
I was sitting next to the NBC News crew with Katie Turr, who's been covering the Trump campaign since day one. And I kept turning to them asking, is this par for the course? Is this normal? And her producer turned to me and goes, this is every single rally. He said the same thing. He throws some red meat to the crowd about the media is terrible and media is awful. Everyone turns around and boos and hisses and says a lot of other very colorful things that aren't appropriate for my audience or your audience right here on WNPR. but it's incredible. He throws these things out to the rally. They say and scream and they hoot and they holler. And then he'll go back to another line. Oh, yeah, and we're going to build a wall. It is an unbelievable spectacle. And I will say this, too. Say what you want. That was far and away the biggest presidential rally we have seen of the campaign cycle in Connecticut, which I don't know what that means, but it was something.
Well, he of course, used some of the lines that he uses everywhere, no matter where he goes. But he also took some time to do a little reading on the state of Connecticut. He went after Governor Daniel Malloy and the state's loss of General Electric.
You got to vote for Trump. You've got to vote for Trump just as a signal to your incompetent governor that you're not going to take it anymore, okay? You got him. You know, he changes his name. I thought it was Daniel. Then I thought it was Dan. Then it's Daniel. Daniel? I never heard of Daniel, right? Where is he now? You're good at this stuff. Where is he now? Daniel? It's Daniel Malloy.
It's Donald Trump. Poking fun at the governor of Connecticut, Colin. I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's always been Daniel. There are many ways in which you could legitimately poke fun at Daniel Malloy. That really isn't one of them. And, I mean, you have to do a little bit more of your homework. You'd have to know a little bit more than, say, the GE left. You know, I don't know how big a fulcrum Dan Malloy is going to be for Donald Trump here in Connecticut. I doubt he's going to help Donald Trump very much. I mean, this it's unlikely. I mean, one of the questions everybody was asking is, what's he doing in Connecticut? I mean, Connecticut's a blue state. You know, there is, I mean, I wrote about this. You could construct this very complicated scenario where Connecticut goes into play, but it really takes a lot. So what is he doing here? What, you know, why spend time doing that unless he has some kind of internal poll that's telling him something else? It was suggested to me that he might have been looking at the Carter Blumenthal internals that had told them something else. But it seems like a waste of his time. And I just quickly want to say the one thing about the press. Okay, he did the same thing about the press when he was in Hartford. But he has ratcheted that up quite a bit. And if we were to imagine a President Trump, one of the more chilling aspects of this is there were questions about whether President Obama was being fair to the press. There were an awful lot of prosecutions of actual reporters and leak cases and stuff like that. And Holder finally kind of dialed that back because they were getting so much pushback and they were being called out on it. Trump would think nothing of using anything he had at his disposal to punish the press, not for some act of, you know, getting confidential or top secret information leaked to them, but just for doing stuff he doesn't like. You know, I actually think we would see an abridgment of the First Amendment, the likes of which you'd have to go back to Thomas Jefferson to see.
Two points on that. Colin's dead on. Number one, the Waterbury Republican American newspaper was banned from this event for reasons we don't know. When you got to the door, I overheard a conversation, maybe I saw it on Twitter, where the question was, well, why were they banned? We're talking about the Waterbury Republican American
newspaper. Of all newspapers
here.
To ban.
Paul Hughes, great writer, a friend, but why on earth would they be banned? And the answer was, you must have done something to frustrate, or I believe the word was pee off the Donald. I don't know if I could say that here, but you did something to frustrate Donald Trump. That's number one. Number two, he talked about possibly banning the New York Times. He talked about how he's already banned the Washington Post. He talked about maybe we should ban other media that I don't like. I mean, this is talk you just don't hear. And as a member of the press, this is something that is, you know, at the very least troubling. If he becomes president of the United States, who will he ban from the White House press room? I think that's a fair question to ask, given what the rhetoric has been on the campaign.
I will say, Susan, you know, one of the interesting things to think about, though, is as you hear these increasingly alarming things coming from the candidate, they are often said in the way we just heard that clip, with a kind of laugh line attached. And one of the consistent criticisms coming back from Trump supporters has been everything from what sounded an awful lot like a request for someone to assassinate Hillary Clinton was just a bit of sarcasm. And the note that we might take away First Amendment credentials from the press is just a little bit of sarcasm. There's a sense that part of what the shtick is just to say these things so that we will get incredibly fired up about it and push back in some way so that we look even worse once again. I don't know that there's any particular reality behind any of this, how concerned we might all be in the press about anything that he says.
Well, back in the 1920s and 30s, there were people that were saying, well, this Hitler guy probably doesn't mean it about the Jews. He's just ginning people up. No, it's this whole thing where, oh, he doesn't mean it. He's just being sarcastic. It's just a lie. How can we take that seriously? How can we say we want to dismiss this, that he is fermenting all of this? I mean, if you hear the crowd in those tapes, they are very, very angry. They're a pretty hateful bunch. If you look at some of the video from the rallies, he may be being sarcastic, but he's stirring up real emotions and real hatred. And it feels like he's opened up another box. And this is what he's done for the past year. He has been opening up these boxes, and it's really hard to close them again.
And as some of these things that may be passed off as sarcastic are coming out one day, almost the next day, Colin, he comes out with a plan for extreme vetting of people coming from other countries, which sounded, frankly, deadly serious in the way he delivered it.
Yeah, I mean, those are the parts that are serious. And I think he has tried to make this campaign, unsuccessfully, tried to make the job of the press differentiating between things he's joking about and things that he's serious about. I have developed this theory over the last week that one of the big influences for Donald Trump in terms of public rhetoric is Don Rickles. And I'm actually serious about this. I mean, you know, and specifically the album Hello Dummy, which I can guarantee you Trump owned as a 20-year-old. And it's full of, you know, Rickles kind of did that. Rickles, of course, had a lot of insult humor. A lot of it was directed at minorities. And then he could always find some way to frame it by saying, you know, of course, we're all one people. I'm just joking. I love everybody. You know, and as a comedian, you could sort of get away with that. I mean, people really liked Don Rickles despite all the horrible things he said about minorities. But even Trump's cadences, I happened to, as a teenager, have listened to that album. Even his cadences are those of Rickles. He actually, like the Second Amendment line about Hillary, is a classic Rickles cadence tag. And now the problem is, Hello Dummy is not a good Rosetta Stone for your campaign. You really it may be a classic comedy album, but you really shouldn't be running a presidential campaign when you're about to get your first intelligence briefing as a potential future president of the United States. Really, Don Rickles shouldn't be one of your big influences.
Well, and even though the notion of Hello Dummy, one of the things he did at this event that you were at, Max, was essentially pre-blame voters for not voting for him. This is an interesting tactic. If I don't win, I'm going to be pretty upset, and I'm going to blame Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Ohio. I'm going to blame you all.
He said this, but he also said it in that deadpan way. He goes, "How could you not vote for me? Why would you not vote for me? How could you not?" It sounded like I thought I was at my Passover Seder for a moment. I mean, it's the way he's saying it, and it's how he's saying it, and it's things you've never heard before on a campaign trail. And then when you talk seriously about even the notion of him winning Connecticut, I ran some basic numbers in my head, right? So if he was to get 80% white voter turnout in Connecticut, right, that still leaves him about 100 or 200,000 voters short when you bring in minority voters and voter turnout in Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport specifically. So I don't know. I think that if we're going to talk about why he was here, I think he was hoping for New York City cameras to show up, and not a single one did. So that kind of tells you what the thought process was about maybe how the media were going to cover it, because it's a Connecticut event, but kind of New York, kind of not. The Greenwich crowd, maybe. I don't know. It was an interesting night.
Boy, I'll just say before we break, Susan, Hillary Clinton actually did the normal Greenwich thing the next night, which is come in, no cameras, raise a couple million dollars.
We're an ATM. It's great. Yeah, just come on in and get your money. That's fine. I think Trump is here for his ego. I think that he wanted to he said, "Oh, I lived in Connecticut." Sure. So now he wants to come here and he wants to rile people up and he wants to see if he can win the state. He's probably been hearing bad news about Arizona and about Georgia, mm-hmm. about states that really he should be winning that he's not. So I think he tries to kind of try and stick it to the Democrats by coming somewhere and trying to make Hillary Clinton play defense here.
One
it's not going to happen.
Out the door, one Trump supporter even said to me, "I love that he's here. I'm so happy to see him for the second time because I saw him in Bridgeport, but I really wish he was in Georgia. I wish he was in Virginia. I wish he was in Pennsylvania."
During the break, we're going to check on the poll numbers for Don Rickles, see how he's doing in those states. We'll be back with Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe. We'll be talking a little bit about state politics coming up next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the week's news with Susan Bigelow, who is a contributing columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com, Max Reese, who is the political reporter for NBC Connecticut, and our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's on your show this afternoon?
We are at long last doing our show about Petula Clark, which, you know how it is with a daily show. You don't have enough time, really. Well, I don't know. We've been working on the show for it's like Chinese Democracy or something. We've been working on it for a really long time. I mean the Guns N' Roses album, not actual Chinese Democracy. Although we've been working on it almost as long as it would take to have actual Chinese Democracy.
The fact that you've taken this long to do a show about Petula Clark is remarkable to me.
We do shows about really important things. Not that Petula Clark isn't, but we don't spend anywhere near this amount of time. Three producers worked on this show. It's broken all records.
It's broken all records. So you will finally hear it this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. Len Fasano, the Connecticut Senate Republican leader, has asked a company that runs the official website for his caucus to stop doing contract work with senators because he wants to avoid an appearance of impropriety. Now, the basic story here, I think, is there a separation between the taxpayer-funded work that the company is doing for Republicans and the political apparatus trying to get those Republicans elected? We're reading all this in a column from the Hartford Courant's John Lender, who's been doing a lot of work on this. Colin, can you help me understand this story?
No. However, it's actually, there's four stories here that are all kind of interrelated. But so the one that you're talking about, there's a guy, I think his name is Justin Gargiulo. He used to be a Republican Senate staffer here in Connecticut. He's got two companies. One of them is called Align Media. Align Media media does, well, here in Connecticut, what they do is using taxpayer money, part of the budget of the Republican Senate caucus, they set up a website for communication purposes and stuff like that. He also owns a company called Voter Trove, and that's more of a data-driven political consultancy. So the question
charmingly
was,
named, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Great name. So the question
that's in House of Cards, I think, isn't it?
That's right. The question would be, does the government contractor Align Media ever turn over useful information collected and processed with our tax dollars, but sitting in the background where average chumps cannot see it, to its sister concern, Voter Trove? Now, this did happen once, definitely, and that was in a Joe Markley campaign where somehow or other information collected by Align Media got into the hands of Voter Trove. We actually have some tape, Jeff Tyson, we have some tape of Justin Gargiulo explaining to Len Fasano how this happened.
Oops. Oops. What does that mean? What do you mean?
No, I got it. Some jerk didn't put...
I say oops, what do you mean saying oops there?
Well, you say we try that one again, huh?
Okay, so they're going to try that one again.
Is that from Boiler Room?
No, it's Independence Day.
Oh, that's right.
So, okay. And I mean, he actually did say we misplaced it. We misplaced all that information. So that's sort of the nub of this. It extends into a much larger story about basically what happens in general when state legislators collect a lot. They're basically email farming all the time, right? People write to them and say, you know, there's something wrong with the, you know, veterinary laws in Connecticut or something like that. Well, they've got that. They capture that email address. They can use it lots of different ways. Ways in which I think they shouldn't be able to anyway. I mean, basically, even these mail pieces you get from your state senator and your, you know, they're unnecessary. They don't, you know, they're a waste of trees, and they amount to campaign activities, even though they're done in the information in the guise of voter information or constituent information. So there are all kinds of questions spiraling around this. It's not just this story. For example, Len Susio, who was the former state senator from the Meriden area, who was deposed by Dante Bartolomeo, is asking for all basically the email address list that she's captured in this precise way. He goes, give it to me. And she's saying, no. And it would seem as though he's entitled to that. That's the argument being offered back is, well, these are people who, you know, wrote to me about their sick cat or their, you know, firefighter husband who's got a, you know, whatever. But I don't think he's really asking for those emails. I think he's just asking for the address list that she's compiled that allows her to communicate with a whole bunch of constituents who are not just likely voters, but probably almost definitely voters. So he just wants that, and I don't see why he shouldn't have it.
I think, well, Susio already has a list from 2014 that he purchased from Voter Trove. The Voter Trove says that, well, that's just the parsed down Secretary of the State voter list that every campaign gets. I think that the reason why this is a significant story is that Senate Republicans paid $100,000 each year for several years to this company. And then campaigns were also using the same company. So now you have the top Senate Republican telling his members and the ones voted running for either re-election or running for office like Susio saying, you guys need to stop using this company because in politics, what's the worst thing you can have? It's bad optics. Even though they may not be using the exact same list, the fact that they're using the same company doesn't look kosher. It just doesn't look right. It's very easy for someone to look at it and say X and Y are the same.
So were we to conceive of a system that didn't cause the problems of optics or actually of – frankly, real problems which could arise from this, how would we devise a system, Max, that's kept these things separate? Could we say you just can't use companies that do this and that at the same time?
And that's a group. Then I think you're running into First Amendment issues because what can you do with your money as a campaign compared to what can you do with your money as somebody who already holds public office? I don't know the answer to that. That's why I'm sitting over here and I'm not over the SEEC, I guess. But I think that Senator Fasano knows this wasn't a great looking thing for them, and that's why he's told them to pull back.
If you were at the SEC, you probably would have already lost your job at some point, some budget cut. So you'd probably be still sitting here anyway, Susan.
Really, they should be using some sort of neutral party. If this is a site that is hosted on the state of Connecticut's website, if it's got a ct.gov address, if it's associated with the official arms of the legislature, the caucuses, or whatever, this should be done by either the state or something that has been approved by by the state by somebody who is neutral. They shouldn't be able to pick their own people because that's just an open door for abuse.
And yeah, I'm not sure that it is a .gov, though. Isn't there something called CT, Senate Republicans?
.com. They're a .com. Right. That's correct.
So they are a .com. You know, in some ways, the biggest problem, and it's an unsolvable problem, is that it's really hard to get legislators to stop doing things that they want to do. Because you know how we say there ought to be a law? Well, guess who passes those laws? And I mean, I actually think there's a lot, there's a bigger problem than this. This stuff is a problem. And by the way, there's a whole other complicated thing going on between Art Linares, a senator from the Essex area, and his opponent, Norm Needleman. I just like saying Norm Needleman.
We're back to my Passover Seder, by the way.
That's right. It's a similar kind of thing to what we're talking about right now. But really, overarchingly, it would be great if they could spend a lot less money trying to get people to like them. You know, taxpayer money. I mean, I don't know. I haven't checked this lately, but like when Chris Donovan was speaker, he had a guy making $165,000 being his kind of message press Chris Donovan marketing guy that we were paying for. Why does he need $165,000 worth of marketing? He's the Speaker of the House.
And there's an entire apparatus behind it, as Colin mentioned before. These mailers that go out, the franking mailers that we see stacked up in the halls. We're paying for those as well. They are essentially meant to be constituent mail, but what they are in actuality is a campaign mailer that tells you, hey, remember this guy who you voted for before, he's going to be running once again. It's all stuff we're paying for. And frankly, Max, we don't have the money to be paying for stuff like this.
It's remarkable. I mean, the state has a system that is legal, that is built in to allow you to keep talking to your constituents every week if you really want to, with some kind of a mailer. And I'm not that we're about to get into the conversation of how long should terms be in Connecticut, but it's a product of two-year terms.
Yeah.
You're always running for re-election. The moment a session ends, you're going back to your district. Well, you're only at that point 13 or 14 months away from another election, whether it's a primary or a general election. And then you can keep sending them mail. You can keep sending them this, keep sending them that. And then somebody has to come up with a new way to get around the existing laws and come up with a new way to get your name in front of somebody.
But what's the amount of money that should go into this? I mean, we just had out of my district, we just had a Republican primary. And I looked at the numbers to see what the final vote total was. And a total of 400 and change people voted in this primary. We are talking about an apparatus, Susan, in which we spend millions of dollars a year for all of these little races that do get run in this very tight cycle. But at the end of the day, the amount of impact that all of this money has is enormously small. Mm. And it only really benefits one or two people, really, who are running for these offices. I just feel like, again, as Colin has said many times, it's really hard to get lawmakers to pass laws that are going to go against their best interests. But it feels as though this is a gigantic waste of time beyond just the optics that this story kicks off.
Right. Well, all it really does is add to the home field advantage that incumbents already possess. And it makes it even harder for them to get kicked out of office. It just makes it much more difficult for any kind of a challenger. And that's a major problem with our system, is that there's hardly any turnover. Incumbents are 95% safe. And this sort of thing, this sort of huge waste of money, like you said, it just adds to that.
And I'll just say, Colin, very quickly, we've been talking about the Republicans and this issue. This is certainly something that has come up in the Democratic Party as well. We've heard stories about this coming out of the actual Secretary of the State's office, which has been democratically held for the last 1.5 million years.
Yeah, two different secretaries of state. I'd like to point out, where you live, sheep and goats are allowed to vote, too. So the fact that only 400 people in Winstead, that's really depressing. Maybe they should spend more money on, like, food pellets or something like that, you know.
All right. I will say, speaking of how much money people make, we're going to turn now to a story that I'm reading from the Connecticut Mirror today. Malloy's administration unveiled plans Tuesday that would privatize 40 state-run group homes and a host of services for the intellectually disabled and eliminate the need for about 605 state jobs. It would save Connecticut about $70 million annually by next fiscal year. The administration, which has already laid off 113 DDS employees, would eliminate another nearly 500 workers in two stages. That means 25% of the full-time positions at the state agency, the DDS, are being eliminated. This sort of came in a little bit in the middle of the summertime under the radar here, Colin. We've known about cuts coming. This feels like an awful big chunk of a big state agency.
Yeah, and it's very hard to say whether this is a terrible thing or just kind of a bad thing or maybe even an okay thing. First of all, we need to know a lot more about DDS than probably most of us know. This is sort of a – one thing that I did was just look on ctsunlight.org today at salaries at DDS. And, you know, it's a really kind of top-heavy government agency. There's about, I think, almost 200 people who make, if you combine earnings and fringe, over $150,000 a year. That's a lot of people. And there's 25 people who, on that basis, make over $200,000 a year. Those tend to be the people who don't get cut in situations like this. I don't know the answer to this. I mean, one part of me says that's one of the places they should look. They should do a study of this department saying, is this like other departments or are we spending a lot of money on people, you know, whose services aren't maybe entirely necessary or are duplicated? I mean, just to the naked eye anyway, it kind of looks that way. I couldn't really prove that. Or the other question would be, you know, has 1199, have the state unions kind of priced themselves out of the market? Have they made the cost of carrying a state employee so high that it's really in the interest of the state and maybe even the client population to do something else, to contract those things out to nonprofits? And I honest to God don't know the answer to that, or maybe a combination of the two. But we did know, as we watched the whole budget thing unfold, that we'd be covering stories like this, where vulnerable populations who don't have any choice in the matter are going to see the way in which they're served disrupted in significant ways.
And this has been a big issue nationwide, where social services are getting privatized. They're being handed off to either quasi-public or private organizations with fairly mixed results. Sometimes it seems to work out okay, but then there's not a lot of oversight, and sometimes it turns into a total disaster. And I think the biggest problem is what Colin was talking about, that there's a lot of upheaval, that people who are used to getting their services in a certain way are not getting the services that way anymore. And that's how you lose people. That's how people can fall off the radar, can fall through the cracks. So this is actually a very dangerous time for a vulnerable population as they transition out of having state services to something that is going to be, well, we don't know what it's going to be yet.
Not to get too politically cynical here, but this is another example where even though Governor Malloy has a social progressive streak in him that makes him a favorite among the National Democratic Party, he has a fiscal hawk in him where he and his administration have said, these are very expensive services. I'm not sure we should be in this business anymore because they're expensive. And then Colin makes a good point that there are a lot of people making a lot of money who aren't providing the actual services. These are the administrative folks. And they're not transitioning every of the state-run facilities to a private nonprofit provider. But what they're saying is, we think these are very expensive and we think there's a better, more effective way, which now, to Susan's point, says to a lot of these families that have in many cases been guaranteed state care for all these years, because Connecticut has guaranteed care to these people for decades and decades and decades. They're saying those people that your family member has been working with for all these years with their care, they may not be there anymore, which creates a new stress, which is maybe an unintended consequence of all this. And I agree with Colin. We don't really know what's good and what's bad. It's probably going to be something we see 2 and 3 years down the line as to what the actual consequence is.
Before we get to a break, I just want to end on it's seemingly a little bit of a bad story here, something that took me a bit by surprise because I did not know about the health of State Senate President Martin Looney. St. Rose of Lima Church in New Haven has made a public appeal for a new kidney for Senate President Looney. Quoting here, "My dear brothers, Senator Looney, a parishioner of Santa Rosa de Lima and a great fighter for this community, is sick. His only kidney is failing. He needs a transplant. There's no one in the family who has a kidney match." I was taken a bit by a surprise by this. You talk to more people down at the Capitol on a daily basis, Max, than I do.
This was kept very quiet. This really was kept very quiet. It's been known about for some time. And now, you know, his staff are saying, well, it's business as usual. I mean, you know, Vin Morrow told the Connecticut Mirror, he told him very succinctly, he's working, he's here, it doesn't affect him. But, you know, as once again, not to get too cynical here, but these are kind of things that then raise questions about, is somebody focusing on their health rather than their political job? Is somebody focusing on their district rather than their health and things like that? But they're going to downplay it. And obviously, Senator Looney is a very, very good man. And you don't want something like this to happen to him.
No, you absolutely don't. I mean, Colin, to the point that Max just made, I mean, we did have an issue that went on for almost the better part of the year around Andy Maynard and whether or not we had a whole bunch of information about his health. This feels certainly quite a bit different. Martin Looney is able to go to work, and we wish him only the best. It is a bit unusual finding it out from the pulpit, essentially.
This can't have been the plan. At least I would be astonished. My guess is that it wasn't really envisioned that this communication that was going on internally within the congregation of the church would leak out this way. I mean, I think that's a rather unsophisticated assumption to make. I mean, in 2016, nothing that you communicate to anybody stays in one place for very long. It's been the lead story at CT Capital Report for the last, I don't know, what, 18 hours or so. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think this is the – I mean, we all know how they roll out information like this when it's time to tell us, and this is not how they do it.
We got to take a break. When we come back, a lot of little stories we haven't gotten to yet this week. Of course, you can always join us at WNPR Wheelhouse on Twitter. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news today with Colin McEnroe, Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.org. Colin, we're reading today in the Hartford Courant this news over the course of the last couple of days that the Comet Diner in Hartford is possibly being torn down. Now, we hear an awful lot about famous old buildings, sometimes major buildings, sometimes things that we don't even think about all that much that are being threatened with the wrecking ball. But the Comet Diner is one that I have been waiting to have reopened for some time. It's a fabulous building. What's the story with the Comet here? Are we going to lose it in Hartford?
I think the likelihood is that we are. In some ways, we've been waiting for it to reopen. We've also kind of been waiting for the shoe to drop. And certainly the people who work here in this building know what a food desert this particular area is. The Comet Diner is not far from where we're sitting right now. There aren't that many places to eat. It's always been a mystery to me why it isn't more successful. I just assume Etnoids must eat Soylent Green or something like that. Because, I mean, it's right next to the Etna. You would think you would just have this built-in constituency. But I'm old enough to, as a child, I went to the old Etna Diner, which is what it was, and it was a rather elegant place at that time. And yes, celebrities went there, and it was across the street from Scholar's, which was the press hangout and politician hangout for a long time, a place where you'd go to maybe, you know, bump into Ribicoff or Jack Zeman or somebody like that. So the whole area was much more vibrant, and I've always had a hard time understanding why this thing can't be made to work. It would seem like there's enough of a constituent population, but it's just, I'm concerned about what will happen next and what, quote, redevelopment, unquote, means in this.
Yeah, if you don't know the building, you know, to take a look online right now on Twitter, there's lots of pictures I'm sure you can find of the old Comet Diner. It's been sitting empty for quite some time. Beautiful, old-fashioned diner that hopefully we don't lose here in Hartford. In the name of progress, Susan, I want to turn quickly to the various high-speed rail plans that have been floated by Amtrak. There's basically three of them that are out there. One follows the shoreline in a way that isn't too dissimilar from the high-speed rail that we have right now. And I'm going to use air quotes now for the purposes of CTN. We'll call it high-speed rail. Mm-hmm. That's nothing like what you find in Europe or Japan or other places. There are two other plans that are actually quite aggressive and interesting that would have a new rail line that goes between Providence and Hartford and even stops in the little cow town of Storrs where there's a major university, don't you know? There's one plan that has a tunnel underneath Long Island Sound to get people to the city and further south even more quickly. It seems unlikely that any of those big plans will ever happen. So we're talking about this fairly simple small plan, which is being held up by people in Old Lyme.
Right. They are concerned. First off, those big plans, I would love it. I would build that tunnel under Long Island Sound. Come on, we've always wanted one of those. Or, you know, the idea of having high-speed rail that passes through Hartford, and imagine being able to get to Providence easily from Hartford. Right now, there's no way to do it. You can't get from Hartford to Providence in an easy way. Imagine being able to take a train there. That'd be phenomenal. It would do wonders for the region. But no, those are too expensive. They're not going to happen. So what Old Lyme is concerned about is that the rail on the shoreline goes right down all through these little crags and nooks and crannies and all that stuff down there. The shoreline, of course, is very jagged, and the rail follows the shoreline. It's very slow. So what they want to do is they want to have the rail kind of cut inland and have it cut through the heart of Old Lyme. And there's a lot of people down there who are very concerned that it's going to ruin the historic character of the village. And now Senator Blumenthal is involved, and everyone's pretty annoyed about this. So whether or not that's going to happen, But, I mean, if they even tried to do any of these large proposals, they would have that same problem. This is a problem of building any kind of rail or new infrastructure in the Northeast.
And it's an interesting kind of fight because Blumenthal and Malloy have been right there on the infrastructure improvements, right there with the FRA, specifically the Federal Rail Administration. But then something like this is a big problem because you question – I would question how much can Senator Blumenthal really say about saying no to a plan like this if they have their heart set on it. He says it's not an arrival, but it's an interesting kind of fight between – one of our U.S. senators, and a historic town that has the amount of charm that everyone thinks of when they think of New England.
Right. So there's a good argument for doing something with the way the rail is in Old Lyme right now. If you've ever been under Point of Woods, which is a beautiful shoreline community there, I mean, the train just goes whipping right past this little peninsula. The argument for redirecting it somehow in the way that Susan is describing – if you could do it in a non-disruptive way that didn't rip up the town green and all that kind of stuff, there's a case to be made for doing that anyway, I would think anyway. I will say that Old Lyme is kind of famously – in the blizzard of 1888, which is the worst storm that's ever hit Connecticut, Old Lyme did not know there was a blizzard happening. They just thought it was snowing out. So
we are contractually obligated because we've asked Max Reese from NBC to Connecticut to come here to talk about the Olympics. I think we're supposed to cue the theme, but we don't have time for that.
That's
Max,
fine.
I mean, what are your takeaways? I mean, your network certainly has been all in once again on the coverage of the Olympics, so I'm sure you've been taking in quite a bit of it. How do you feel about these Olympics as you watch them from afar?
Well, first of all, my colleague Kevin Nathan has done some wonderful work, and we have some great Connecticut connections. We have a guy running the steeplechase. We have guys in the and girls on the crew team and the swim team and stuff like that. You hoped against hope that there wouldn't be any of the bad news that came out of the Olympics. So everyone was hoping that Rio would be fine. And now we have wildfire burning up the mountain biking facility. You had the gunpoint holdup of Ryan Lochte. But we've had great storylines. I mean, what I'll say is, you know, these sports that don't get any notoriety during the year, we wouldn't know who Simone Biles is otherwise, unless you're somebody who's that tuned into the international gymnastics scene, which I'm not sure there are that many in Connecticut. So it's been a good Olympics. I wish there weren't some of these other storylines, but, you know, it's the Olympics. And Susan and I were talking off camera about what will happen with the next bidding process. Will an American city hold another Olympics, given all the civil rights and human rights issues?
And the bid for 2024 is going to be decided next year, next September, I believe it is. And our candidate city was initially Boston. That didn't work out because there was huge opposition to it. So the candidate city is now L.A. And they're competing against Paris, and I believe it's Budapest. And we'll see. The Olympics kind of goes in cycles. They award it based on whose sort of turn it is by continent. And I don't think it's going to be Paris because the London Olympics is pretty fresh in everybody's mind. I think LA has a good shot if they can get the public backing for it, and that's always a question.
Well, you know, L.A. famously was the one Olympics that really didn't cost money, right? Uberoth, because he was able to marshal so much corporate support, and because L.A. had the kind of infrastructure, they just said...
And it still does.
Yeah,
it does.
They just said to UCLA and USC, you guys are the Olympic Village right now. You're dorms. You're the Olympic Village. So it was the cheapest in terms of public outlay, probably Olympics of the last 50 or more years, even adjusted for inflation.
But the Olympics is such a poison pill right now. It's very unpopular for it to come to any city at all because there's always such a disaster after it leaves.
Well, Max was talking about some of the storylines that are good, some of the storylines that aren't so good. I just want to quickly say I read the story of the Chinese swimmer Fu Yuanhui, who openly talked after a heat about having her period during the competition. She was writhing in pain, and when asked, she said, it's because I got my period yesterday, so I'm a bit weak and really tired, but this isn't an excuse for not swimming well. I love this story because it pointed out something that I didn't know. I mean, we learned something about sports we didn't know anything about, and we learned something about cultures we didn't know anything about. I didn't understand the rejection of open conversation about menstruation in many Asian communities, including all across China. And she's being hailed as a hero, a heroine, for speaking up and saying something in the midst of competition that I think changed an awful lot of people's minds, and something very important.
No, that's very true. And we don't talk about menstruation in sport for women at all. In the United States, we don't talk about it. So this was actually a remarkable moment. I was actually seeing people on Twitter being like, wait, girls can swim when they have what? When they have their periods? What? And there was a lot of misinformation, so good for her. She's amazing, an amazing athlete, amazing person.
And we're going to leave the last word for Colin.
All right. Also, just Slate gets some credit for having done a story about periods of menstruation in the Olympics before they started. They actually saw this coming. So you might be listening to the show and saying, I just hate the wheelhouse. There's no newsmakers. It's a bunch of reporters running their mouths. Whose fault is this anyway? Well, you could say it was John McLaughlin's fault. In some ways, he's the guy who really kind of created a style of talk show where you don't have newsmakers. You have a bunch of reporters running their mouths. And it's a little bit more informal and zippy and a little bit less serious than some of the things that had preceded him, like Firing Line, Washington Week in Review, and the always hilarious Gagronsky and Company. So John McLaughlin, who died at the age of 89, and who I met in 2000 at the Republican Convention and got to interview, and was aware that he was always wearing this specific persona as opposed to his real identity. If you want to blame somebody for the wheelhouse, before you send that email going, Colin's too sarcastic on the wheelhouse, it's all John McLaughlin's
fault. I'll stop sending those emails, Colin.
May he rest in peace.
Rest in peace indeed. I should maybe turn quickly to Max and go, Reese, what do you have? But we won't do that. That's we won't go around the table like that.
Scale of 1 to 10.
We will just say Max Reese, NBC Connecticut political reporter. Thank you so much. Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.org and also Colin McEnroe, who you can hear this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. I'm John Dankosky. Join us again next week for The Wheelhouse.